Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. I recently had the opportunity to talk with Dr. April Zioli, who comes to us from the University of Michigan. Dr. Zioli is a public health scholar and so brings that body of work, that scholarship to our conversation as we discuss the research around the use of guns in intimate partner violence. It's definitely a important topic, a heavy topic. And so I remind you to, as always, please take care of yourself and listen to our episodes when and if you are ready. We're thrilled you're here no matter what. So grab your coffee and enjoy this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Hello and welcome. I am very excited to be here today to talk with you. And I'm wondering if we start off with who's in the room. So if you could introduce yourself, who you are, and the work that you do.
My name is April Zioli. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. And I am a firearm violence researcher. My focus has been on intimate partner homicide and firearm laws that are directed towards those who commit intimate partner violence. And more recently, I have been examining extremist protection order laws. Those are commonly known as red flag laws. And I look at implementation of firearm laws as well.
I think that every line of what you just said, I was like, oh gosh, I want to ask about that and ask clarity on that and ask clarity about that. So I'm not entirely sure where I want to begin. But if I'm thinking about someone who is listening and might just have no exposure or understanding to this work in this field and sort of the few things that you just mentioned, can you maybe go into expanding on what, when you think about research related to firearm laws that are directed towards those that commit intimate partner violence, can you maybe expand a little bit more and give us that kind of introductory overview of what we're talking about when we think about that?
Sure. In the mid-90s, the federal government passed a pair of laws directed at people who are known to have committed intimate partner violence. And one says that if you are currently under a domestic violence restraining order, and that your victim is a current or former spouse, someone you've had a child with, or someone you've cohabited with, then you can't purchase or possess a gun. And the other law says that if you've been convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence, you can't purchase or possess a gun. Now, the restraining order, firearm restriction law, is only for the lifetime of the restraining order. So it's a temporary restriction. But the misdemeanor conviction law is a lifetime restriction. Most states at this point have their own version of these two laws. And those laws, they vary from state to state and who is covered. For the federal law, I mentioned it's, you know, current or former spouses, have a child, live together. Some states add dating partners, for example. Some states add those temporary restraining orders that are put in place very quickly that the federal law doesn't cover. So these laws exist across the United States in various forms. And the research that I've done has looked at the impact of a state having this law. So if the state you live in has this domestic violence restraining order firearm restriction, is intimate partner homicide in the state affected? When the law came into place, did intimate partner homicide levels go down? That would have been the goal of the law.
Yeah.
To reduce intimate partner homicide. And the research suggests that, in fact, when these laws were introduced in the various states, intimate partner homicide went down. And not just for intimate partner homicides committed with guns, but total intimate partner homicides as well.
Oh, wow.
And the way that would work is if people were not replacing guns for other weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this research was only at the state level. I've done that research at the city level as well. So we haven't looked at individuals yet and seen, you know, who was under a restraining order and whether they had a gun and all of that. But hopefully that will still come.
Yeah. That was really, really helpful and really interesting and very clear. So thank you for that. I am curious to hear, like, you're, you know, kind of getting us to a good place to talk about the future of that work and kind of where we go with it. But I'm wondering if before we get there, if you can explain also the sort of red flag laws, the extremist laws.
So an extreme risk protection order is a civil court order. It is not part of the criminal side. You don't get a criminal record from having an extreme risk protection order against you. It is a civil order that says that at this point, you are high risk for harming yourself or harming others, and you shouldn't have a gun. So this is also a temporary restriction from purchasing and possessing a gun. And it really is designed for people who are in crisis, people who are suicidal, for example, or people who are violent against others. So somebody who's made death threats, for example, against someone else. And the judge ruled that this was a credible threat and they needed to not have access to a gun right now.
Yeah. I imagine that the work around understanding the role that firearms play in intimate partner violence is incredibly important, but also something that has really, or firearm use in general, has really seen a lot of an unfortunate greater attention in our country over the last 5 to 10 years. For you, what do you see illuminated the continued need for this work, or like the impact that understanding violence perpetration by the use of firearms, like why that has been demonstrated as being a critical area to understand?
Well, I am constantly surprised isn't quite the right word, but there are basic questions that we don't know the answers to. Like, how many non-fatal shootings are there a year in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't know. Not a good surveillance system to capture that information. NIJ is funding some studies right now, I believe, that would work towards that, or NCGBR might be funding some as well. So we're trying to get there, but you know, that's a really basic piece of information, and we really are not sure. And the data that we have, we're pretty sure are wrong.
Yep, yep.
So there's just not much research on non-fatal firearm injuries.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have data that are valid, you're not going to get answers that are valid.
Yeah. And it's interesting how often that does come up in my conversations and in talking with researchers of like, we know that there's an issue on what happens maybe 5 steps down the line. We've collected data on that step 5. We don't have part 1. And so understanding the kind of basic, the root. And I know that that's not exactly what you're saying, but that element of like, we collect the kind of extreme version of the data because it's obviously wildly important and devastating, but that in order to understand the full scope, I need to also be able to understand just how frequently this is happening that may not lead to the absolute worst possible outcome.
No, I think that's spot on. And actually, the reason I came to be a researcher that focuses on intimate partner homicide is because when I started on this process in the mid-2000s, there were no representative sources of non-fatal intimate partner violence firearm injuries.
Right.
So yeah, we go to the extremes because we're better at counting homicide than we are non-fatal injuries.
Right. Absolutely. I think obviously that's a beautiful segue to ask you that question of like, can you talk a bit about just your pathway here? What led you to this work and to being the researcher that you are today?
Sure. Yeah, I was in college and my undergrad at the University of Michigan, and I really had no idea what I wanted to do. Like, truly none. If you are a college student and don't know what you want to do, it's perfectly fine. You'll figure it out. So then I looked around and realized that a lot of my female friends were being abused by their boyfriends. Mm. And I just thought someone should really do something about this. And I'm not one to just leave it at that. I thought I should do something about this.
Hmm.
And, you know, that led me to the field of intimate partner violence. I got a master's in public health to study that. And then I eventually went to get my PhD. And that's where I refined that I really did want to focus on the use of guns in intimate partner violence. And of course, the homicide came for the reasons we just discussed. But I had tried other things in the field of intimate partner violence, working at a victim services agency and things like that, and had realized that I am not personally cut out for kind of direct service care.
Sure.
And research is the place where I can do a much more impactful job. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's always interesting to hear from folks kind of the different disciplines that lead them to a space where we're kind of all approaching the reality of understanding and addressing intimate partner violence. So for you, you have a background in public health and sort of, it sounds like a bit of that trajectory toward the issue. Can you talk about how having that framework or being in a public health maybe mindset has also shaped how you ask the research questions that you do or are interested in understanding this from that perspective?
Yeah, I think that public health is a fantastic perspective. It's we're all about prevention, about doing the research, testing the, you know, interventions, tweaking the interventions, you know, finding root causes and working on those. What's been interesting is that the first 14 years of my career, post earning my PhD, I was a faculty member at Michigan State University School of Criminal Justice. Mm. And, you know, so I was a public health researcher, suddenly
in a criminal justice
criminologist, yeah. Right? And to some extent, we spoke different languages about the same things.
Sure.
And had different perspectives about the same things. Mm-hmm. My version of public health, you know, my studying of firearms, it very much mechanistic. The firearm is the mechanism that is used to cause harm. Mm-hmm. And so what can we do about that? Mm. I don't use individual level theory.
Sure.
Very much. I'm not terribly concerned with how someone came to want to use violence because
you saw at a population level of like this, the broader, yeah. I'm interrupting you, but I think if that's okay, but that I've at least learned as I get older is that there's a benefit in understanding the way that you think through a problem as a researcher and a benefit to understanding where your strength lies, that there are people who addressing a problem from an individual perspective and learning the behavioral decisions, they're going to thrive in that environment and the ability to understand and analyze that. And for you, knowing that like that's not where your discipline, training, and probably personal interest lies. For you, you're like, I know that my interest is looking at the larger ways in which population and like you're saying, the mechanism is available and or not available to allow for this harm to be perpetrated. And even to what you're talking about with being a public health trained human in a criminologist world for a while, there are values in understanding and seeing the different languages because each language is coming. And why similarly, I ask about like kind of your training because everybody comes with a different discipline and learning and the way that they address it and strength inherent in that. And it helps, I think, for any of us to ask those relevant questions, but also on a listening perspective to hear that like we're all coming with a bit of a lens and that lens informs the way that we ask questions and the way that we understand the problem. And they're all valuable in their different right to hopefully build a puzzle together that gives us a like individual systems mechanism to sort of see the whole thing.
Right. And, you know, I deeply hope that people who are focused on root causes and individual level theory get to make those necessary changes in society so that we don't have people who get to the point where they would pull a gun on their intimate partner or anybody. But we're not there. And my focus is through my research, finding out what policies, what programs make it less likely that someone will use a gun against their partner or other people.
Absolutely. What would you say if someone's going to listen to or only take away one thing, we'll say two because it's a really tough question. From what you have learned or surmised from your scholarship so far, what would you want someone to know? Like, what would you want those like tidbits of information about your work for someone to understand?
I think it is of the utmost importance for people to know that my research and the research of others suggests that we can prevent gun violence. We can, through laws that restrict dangerous people from having guns, reduce homicide. And the reason I really expound on that, the reason I, you know, want to highlight that is because I hear a lot, I'm sure everybody listening has heard people say, oh, if you prevent someone from having a gun, they're just going to get another gun. They're just going to commit homicide a different way. And essentially they're saying, well, what's the point? You're not going to change anything. But research suggests that you might change things, that a couple lives could be saved. And that's a huge win.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't want to end here, but there's like the part of me that's like, okay, we got to just like end on that soundbite because that's vital information. Because that message is not widely distributed, that we can demonstrate from data that preventing gun violence is possible.
Yes.
Period. Folks don't know that enough. And of course, there's the how, you know, but like just the simple fact that it is there, it is possible. Mm-hmm. That possibility is hopeful.
Oh, it's absolutely hopeful. It's an optimistic message. And there's a lot we can do to improve our likelihood of reducing homicide. And we can get into that if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd love to hear you speak a bit about that if that feels comfortable.
Sure. One good example is, let's talk about those domestic violence restraining order firearm restriction laws again. Some states, a good proportion of states at this point, have laws that say that if you are prohibited from having a gun, law enforcement or the court, a judge can require you to relinquish any guns you already own. And this is kind of a no-brainer, right? You'd think that would be part of it anyway. So the judge says you are no longer allowed to own guns. That means that any guns you currently own, currently possess, are now illegal guns. You are breaking the law by having them. But we know that in a lot of places, that next step of a judge telling you you have to relinquish all of your guns, and then the criminal justice system making sure that that happens, doesn't actually occur at the rates we would like it to. So we need to work on implementation. We need to work on making sure that when a judge says that someone can't have a gun, that they don't have a gun.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the barriers to that happening right now?
I'm actually doing research right now looking into that. By the end of the year, I should have some answers.
Well, like I'm give or take a few months. Look, like we won't hold you to that.
Yeah, but what I hear from a lot of places are that what I hear from jurisdictions, so the people who work in the justice system, is that they don't know how. Mm. They're not sure if the law allows them to do this, right?
Yeah.
The law doesn't allow law enforcement officers to just take property. Right? There has to be a warrant. There has to be some legal authority under which they do this. And if the law isn't specific about it, then the question, under what legal authority am I doing this? Am I going to someone's house and asking them to give me their gun?
Mm.
You know, comes up.
Yeah.
So to an extent, the laws need to be more clear. Then there are logistic questions. My favorite, and I'm saying this from an ironic place, is when I hear, but then there'll be so many guns that we have to take. Where will we store them?
You're like, I need that. That can't be the reason we say no to this.
Like, it's like, wow, you know that there are so many people that are not allowed to have guns, but have them.
Right.
That your concern is storage.
Right. So, just as long as you have them and someone who is possibly a danger to themselves or others does not, we are in better shape than we were before.
You know, and there are things that can be done around storage.
Right.
There are some communities that are doing a fantastic job with all of this. And I think the last reason is just will.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of work to figure out who has guns and to go and get those guns.
It makes me think about conversations and debates about sort of the role of law enforcement versus a different professional or type of professional that I hold a lot of sympathy or, you know, we see it in the medical setting on teachers, pretty much everyone, where it's like there's a lot of asks of law enforcement in particular of like kind of the broad spectrum of what they are understanding and sort of handling without sometimes a lot of technical support on the other end. That it's just like, okay, well, we've decided that this is going to happen. Now go do. And there's not a lot of support for that. And so there's the contextual understanding of why the will might not be there. The questions around storage exist. The lack of kind of implementation is a reality. But kind of to the point of stepping outside of that space, at the end of the day, if we want to see change happen, we have to be able to figure out how do we support this project or process? How are we supporting it with the actual infrastructure to play out what is a policy or a rule and not just stop as the, like, well, we made it law. We can't help it if it's not being implemented. You know, like we need that next step.
And I suspect in these states that have this law, generally somebody can turn their gun in so they can go to the jurisdiction that's designated, you know, and turn it into law enforcement. And that seems to be a fairly easy process for law enforcement to handle. They just collect the guns that come in, but it does rely on the person who may not really want to get rid of their guns to voluntarily come in.
Right.
I suspect that for removing guns will always want a police officer involved. But whether that's the only role, the only type of government official or worker, however we want to describe, that we want involved is an open question. And probably, depending on the case, you would want maybe some more social worker, for example, with extreme risk protection orders, if we're talking about an individual who is suicidal.
Yeah.
You know, then you would want a more supportive person there potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you speak a bit, so thinking or shifting toward the work that you do have going on and the research that you have currently, can you talk about what projects you have kind of in the works at this moment, what you're focused on currently, but also why it has been critical to understand this area as it pertains to the reduction of partner violence?
On the partner violence front, a large study that I'm just embarking on, that I kind of mentioned part of it, that look into why relinquishment of guns isn't necessarily happening in some communities. But the other arm of that study is a look at petitioners for those domestic violence restraining orders who have had gun-involved intimate partner violence. And, you know, we're doing this in three different states. We're recruiting those petitioners right around the time that they petition, and we're going to follow them for 6 months. And in these three states, they have three different laws pertaining to these firearm restrictions and who can get them and at what point you can get them, and is there a relinquishment law? Is there not a relinquishment law? So what we'll be able to do once we've recruited our petitioners is look at what happened once they get into this case. And when I say case, I mean the court case around the restraining order. Do they get a restraining order? Does the judge grant it? Does the judge deny it? In the state where it's up to the judge whether or not you get a firearm restriction, do they get the firearm restriction? If there's a firearm restriction in all three states, is it implemented? So are any guns the respondent to the restraining order has removed? And what are the outcomes? You know, do the petitioners feel like they are safer? Do they know whether or not the gun has been removed? Have they been threatened? Have they been threatened with a gun? Has violence occurred? You know, so we're really trying to find out what's going on. As I mentioned at the beginning of our talk, you know, we have these research studies at the state level that's only looking at the state numbers and how those are changing. This study is going to look at individuals and what is happening with them.
Amazing. I imagine that's going to be some really useful data for you to have.
I'm so excited.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's one. Do you have a second project happening?
I have a bunch of projects.
You're like, two. Tell me about five.
The other big one, so I have a lot of projects, but there are two that take up most of my time that I'm the lead researcher on. And this other one is on extremist protection orders.
Okay.
It is a 6-state study. It is the first, to our knowledge, research study on extreme risk protection orders that involves more than one state. And we have spent over a year abstracting data from the petitions in these 6 states. So we've coded, I think it's over 5,000 petitions.
Wow.
What we're doing with that information, you know, some of the information that we've coded is whether a mass shooting threat had been made, whether violence reported was against an intimate partner, whether they were suicidal, whether substance use was involved, you know, just a whole host of risk factors. We're going to do many things with this information, including, you know, create typologies of who are respondents to extreme risk protection orders. These laws are very new. Only 3 states had them before 2016. We don't know all that much about them. We want to know how they're being used. That's where the typologies come in. We want to know what factors are related to these orders being granted versus denied. And we are looking at suicide outcomes as well. We're looking at suicide outcomes at the county level. So is the number of extreme risk protection orders that are active in a county month associated with the number of gun suicides,
you know, okay,
in the county month? You know, we're also looking at mental health reports alongside these extreme risk protection orders. So are these people who have been put into the mental health system by the state? So this would be like 5150 in California, Baker Act in Florida. I forget what it's called in Connecticut, you know, but looking at those from state,
right,
seeing what that co-occurrence is like, and just a whole lot. I mean, there's a whole lot we're going to do. Mass shooting threats. Yeah. You
know,
so,
oh, wow.
What is happening? What types of mass shooting threats are being petitioned for?
You know,
who's making them? What are the threats about?
You know, yeah.
What is the proportion that are school shooting threats versus, again, intimate partner homicides that could turn into mass shootings? And
right,
there's a lot of information.
Any of this work is heavy. Mm-hmm. I think particularly thinking about homicide and gun facilitated homicide is particularly physically violent. What's your tools for managing the reality of that? I know research allows us to be a little bit removed, but there's a lot of the research out there that demonstrates that, you know, secondary trauma is real, and like engaging with stories from people and seeing the reality is a traumatic impact in and of itself for researchers who are doing it on a day-to-day basis. But it's also what we see with sort of our 24-hour news cycle, that folks are constantly engaging with pretty intense narratives, and we're not always aware of the toll it can take for us. So it's not a traditional question that I asked, but I think just considering the very useful data and like what you just mentioned is so encompassing too, of just like you're going to be able to see a lot of cross sections, which is amazing. And also my immediate thought was just like, oof, talking about gun violence on a daily basis.
Say every day.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
But it's actually convenient, I don't know, apropos that you bring that question up, because one of the papers that is being led by one of my doctoral research assistants is on secondary trauma for research in gun violence. We've coded over 5,000 petitions. That takes a lot of research assistants to do. We have been very cautious about potential mental health concerns while doing this project, particularly during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And we've taken a number of steps. We have weekly team meetings, smaller group team meetings. We have a lot of coders. Mm-hmm. You know, but we try to, you know, meet in smaller groups that people can get comfortable with.
Sure.
And be able to talk about the case that's bugging them this week. There are cases that are just not going to leave your mind, and everybody has their triggers. So we meet in these small groups every week. We have a social worker, a clinical social worker, who is available to talk to people, you know, not as their therapist, but if they need something right then, she is available to talk with people and to help them find resources within their community to put them to more longer term if they need to. She's actually going to be one of the co-authors on this paper.
Awesome. And
we've done a number of other things, but we let coders say they don't want to code. We sign cases and anybody can say, I'm not going to code that case. No questions asked,
because it
might be one of their triggers.
Yeah.
And they can take a week off coding or however much time. We've had coders, you know, that we've switched jobs to, you know, they're getting a little rough around the edges and you know, for the next month, you're going to do this other thing. So we really try to be conscious of it and help our coders avoid truly secondary trauma.
Right.
But it is hard.
Yeah. I mean, it's really great to hear some of the steps that you've taken, because similarly, I think that in project management, folks, it's often overlooked in just a way that it's not structurally built into a lot of the ways that we design projects or methodologies or data collection steps. And yet, right in this conversation, it's so clearly critical to be able to have those mechanisms. And even if we want to take the human element out of it, which I don't think we should, because it's important to value people. And on the other side, if we want sound research, you also need people who are sound in themselves. And so asking someone to continue to work in a way that is not going to support their own mental health means you're not going to get good data either. And so you're not going to get good analysis. And again, I don't think that's the lens that anyone should be taking. But for the steadfast folks who don't want to build in things to their protocols.
Oh, no, your data's the mess.
Yeah, it's, you know, from that standpoint, I'm glad obviously at the end of the day, I would hope that none of us need to be doing any work that is triggering to any of us ever in any field. But, you know, that version of a utopian world is just not realistic and probably not something that would actually yield the fruits of our imaginations anyway. But at the end of the day, like taking the steps you can to support staff is really important in the environment.
I think part of it is having the right mindset. That sounds trivializing, but what I mean is that you can look at it as, wow, I'm reading about the worst of humanity, right? Or you can look at it from a perspective that there is so much good to be done here, and I am going to do good here.
Absolutely. As a last question, I always like to ask folks, if you were to have just thinking about next steps and gaps in the field, if someone were to give you unrestricted pot of money to do your work with, where would you put it? What would you do?
Oh, man, this question. I shouldn't have known it was coming.
I love it.
I've answered it a lot of different times, and I think each time has been completely different. Just where my head is at the moment.
Sure.
You know, but if I could have all of the money in the world, you know, to do this research, I think I would want better walkers. That sounds stupid, but there are so many questions that we can't answer in research because we don't have the data. Mm-hmm. And there are so many things that the data exists somewhere. It's just not accessible. It's not accessible in an economically feasible, you know, kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
When people ask me things like, well, how many people commit intimate partner homicides while they're under a restraining order? The answer is, I have no idea. None. And I know I cannot find that data. I have tried. You know, so if we had better data linking systems and had access to things like intimate partner restraining orders that we could use to really, in a much more nuanced way, find out if these policies are working the way they're designed to, if they don't look like they're working at the individual level, you know, how can we fix that? There are so many things we just don't know.
Yeah.
And access to good, high quality justice system record, I think would go a long way.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure to talk to you and learn from you. I don't know what the future of these conversations will necessarily be long term, but if the opportunity presents itself, I'd love to talk to you after some of your data is published toward the end of the year or like things are coming out and just like hearing more about what you're learning and finding, because it's incredibly timely and interesting and there's a lot there to be done, as you've mentioned. And so thank you for the work and your energy.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.